ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Hezbollah is a mix of different things. On one hand, it's a political party. It's also a social service network. I mean, they have hospitals, they have pharmacies, they have schools. It's also an ideology.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. In last Thursday's episode, we talked about one of the most sophisticated intelligence operations in recent history, when Israel planted bombs in thousands of pagers and walkie-talkies used by the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah.
Handheld radios used by members of the armed group detonated simultaneously a day after thousands of pagers were exploded in a similar fashion, leaving behind destruction and even death.
It was an extraordinary operation, but it wasn't the first time something like this has happened. History is full of examples of people who tried to outsmart spies, only to actually play right into their hands, when the tools people trusted to keep them safe turned out to be the real danger. Kara Jensen-McKinnon is the supervising producer of this show, and she doesn't know what I'm about to talk about. Hello, Kara.
Hello. I've been brought in. I'm not under duress, I can confirm.
Okay, before we get to the other examples that I've found of this, just remind us of how these pages ended up in Hezbollah's hands.
Yeah, so they've decided that they need these pages. So they go to Gold Apollo and this saleswoman who they've done this business with before, and she says, you know, I don't have any of those old pages, but I do actually have a whole shipment of these new special shiny pages, and I can give them to you for free.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, you know, clearly a great deal for them, but a big mistake. And then, as we kind of outlined in the episode, they each contained explosives.
I subsequently figured out that they didn't give all the pages for free.
Yes.
It was like a sample box. What do you think of these pages? And one of the incredible things was, as we talked about in last week's episode, Gold Apollo was a Taiwanese company, but they were not the company that was actually selling the pages to Hezbollah. This woman who had worked for Gold Apollo had then basically been hired by Mossad to be the face of their front company where they were selling these Mossad-made pages. And one of the extraordinary things from that story was other people started contacting the Mossad front company asking, we hear that you're selling or perhaps giving away pages.
Boxes of free pages.
And so the Mossad company was like, all of our pages have bombs in them.
Yes.
We don't want to give you the pages, but they couldn't sort of say, well, they're not for sale. So what they started doing was they started quoting outrageous prices.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know what the prices were or indeed what a reasonable price to pay for a pager is in 2024.
Yeah.
I would have thought like $10, but I don't know.
The other thing to me is like as a child who grew up watching The West Wing and ER, I really assumed that pagers would be a bigger part of our adult life. And I've never even held a pager in my life. As an adult or as a child. I've never even seen one in real life.
Oh, my father had a pager for like a brief period of time in the late 90s. And people would, you know, send a message to the pager. And basically the message was just call me back.
Right.
The only message that anybody sent to pagers was just like, I need to talk to you. Can you call me back? It was very low tech. Which is exactly what Hezbollah wanted.
It makes sense.
And so that's the story behind this vulnerability that had been basically created by Hezbollah being paranoid of having phones. And I was kind of going, well, why couldn't they just have burner phones, you know?
Yeah.
And the reason was that Israel is able to basically pick up through signals intelligence strange patterns of people buying new SIM cards and calling each other. So it kind of doesn't even help to get burners. Right. Like, they can't listen in on your calls necessarily, but they can sort of go, these people are all talking to each other at this time and in this pattern, and so they can get information from it. But for some reason, you can't get that from pages. I mean, I'm not even sure that that is true of pages. It may have just been something that they were told about pages because of this next story, which is about a company called Crypto AG. This is kind of the absolute gold standard of what we're talking about here, which is a supply chain attack. I'm going to send you their website. It's an archived version of their website because their website doesn't exist anymore for reasons that will become obvious as I continue telling the story.
I'm opening it up. It's a very old school webpage.
Yes, this is from 2002.
It looks very 2002. Kind of web 1.0 by the looks of it. There's information here about Crypto AG. One stop is not enough. Mm-hmm. Crypto AG is the one and only choice if you are looking for an independent partner for your security solutions.
Yeah.
And then there's various images of like guys getting into cars and military-looking people doing serious stuff.
People who have very busy lives.
Yeah, these are
serious
guys. They've
got very busy lives. They're businessmen. They're doing important things.
Yeah.
Now, at the very bottom of the website, you can see their address. Can you see where that is?
It's in a very long word in Switzerland.
Yes.
Yes.
So, Crypto AG is a company that, by 2002, obviously had a website, but Crypto AG was born in the 1950s. As a private company that could create cryptographic solutions to allow you to send messages without the messages being understood. Now, do you know anything about the way that things were encrypted in the World War II era? What I'm actually asking is, have you seen the Benedict Cumberbatch movie, The Imitation Game?
I have seen that movie. It's basically... Is this a Turing test movie?
It was about Alan Turing, who the test is named after.
Oh, right, yes. It was about the time before that test existed.
Yes, yes. So Alan Turing was like a British computer pioneer during the 1940s. And, you know, the thing that he became famous for is the Turing test, which is something that we once used to try and tell the difference between a machine and a human, if you're talking to a machine and a human trying to tell the difference between them, which AI has passed quite some time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But what he did during World War II was basically the Germans had invented this cryptographic machine. They called it the Enigma machine.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember looking at one of these things? You
remember I just remember the plot of the movie washing back over my mind.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the Enigma machine, basically just like a keyboard or like a typewriter looking thing, but you would sort of put in settings into it and you would be like told – on this date, you know, on the 2nd of July, this is the way that you set up the machine.
Yes.
And then, so for example, on the keyboard, you could press M and like the E letter would light up.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
And so as you typed, it would tell you a totally different letter and you would then send your message that sort of seemed totally random and indecipherable. Because, like, you would type, if you're listening, and it would come out as G-H-E-P, whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Like a cipher.
Exactly like a cipher. And then the person, you would send the message, whether it was like a radio message or a telegram or a physical letter to whoever it was you were sending it to. And that person then, if they had the same settings on their Enigma machine, would type in what your message said and it would decode it, basically.
Yes.
And the whole story of the movie is about them figuring out how to decrypt the Germans' messages, the encrypted messages. So after World War II, this company, Crypto AG, started basically selling this type of machine, like Enigma machines, except even more advanced, to businesses, companies, governments, whoever wanted to encrypt messages to each other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was basically set up exactly the same way, a very analog sort of mechanical thing with plugs and knobs and that kind of thing. And by the 1970s, the guys who ran Crypto AG did know people who were sort of in the US government. And so they would sort of talk to the people in the US government from time to time. But by the 1970s, the US was basically saying to them, your machines are just too good now. It's reached the point where your machines are so like detailed and so good that it's mathematically impossible for us to crack the codes that are being sent. and we don't like that.
Right. But surely that's a good, I mean, that's an advertisement for their capacity as a security company, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what you want. They're a really excellent company.
That's great.
They were really cornering the entire global market. So the CIA, the NSA, and their West German intelligence counterparts bought Crypto AG. Mm-hmm. They bought the whole company.
Okay, the big dogs.
And they said, we're not actually going to make the analog rotor ones anymore. We're going to sell like digital ones. So it was essentially just like a sort of a digital 1970s typewriter.
Yes.
Like all of the encryption stuff, you don't have to plug anything in. You don't have to do any of those weird things. All the encryption stuff is done inside the machine by like microchips, and it's way simpler.
Okay.
But in fact, okay, what they'd done is they'd set up the machines so that no matter what the settings were on the machines, no matter how you encrypted your messages, the NSA and the West Germans would be able to read them.
Oh, good. They are sneaky like that. I mean, that's been their general vibe since the beginning.
Absolutely.
So.
And so they sold these machines. Hang on, I'll send you a map of their client list.
Okay. Oh, good. The usual suspects.
It's basically everybody.
Exactly. All of South America, all of Central America, almost all of Africa, almost all,
yes,
of Asia, basically. Almost all of Southeast Asia.
Eastern Europe.
Yeah, it would be faster to list the countries that aren't covered by this.
Iran is there, and all, yeah, of the countries that are generally sort of a bit hostile towards the United States. You can see Vietnam is there, but notably and crucially, China and Russia are not on the map. They kind of saw the whole thing as a bit suspect, so they didn't do it.
Yes.
But the point was that all of those countries that you can see there, which is basically every country between Indonesia and Mexico.
All countries.
were sending what they thought was highly encrypted, totally unbreakable messages, which the Americans basically just could read straight away. It was basically they were just sending open text messages, according to the Americans.
Okay.
Now, I'll send you a paragraph from the eventually declassified report on the effectiveness of this. So the Germans ended up bailing out of it in 1993. This is talking about the time when the Germans and the Americans were in league together,
okay,
over this system.
It says, the American-German partnership on Minerva...
Yeah, Minerva's like the code name.
...has continued for over 20 years. To the Americans, it represented over 40% of the NSA's total machine decryptions and was regarded as an irreplaceable resource. To the Germans, however, it was even more important, accounting for 90% of the BND's diplomatic product reports. The BND regarded it as the linchpin of its highly productive intelligence relationship with the Americas.
So 40% of the information that the NSA was gathering,
wow,
and 90% of what the Germans was gathering was because all of these countries were using machines that they sold them.
That's crazy.
Isn't that amazing?
This is trickery.
Like, all of these countries had the old school rotor-based systems, the analog systems. And the company, Crypto AG, basically said to them, oh no, those are too insecure. You need to buy these new digital systems for all of this. Whereas the analog systems were totally unbreakable. There was absolutely nothing wrong with them at all.
Wow.
They did send two versions of the same product line. So they'd send the real ones that actually couldn't be cracked to friendly governments and banks, and everybody else got the rigged model.
Yep.
The other amazing thing is it was a significant profit-making business.
Well, yeah. I mean, you look at all these customers.
Yeah, yeah. So it made millions and millions of dollars in profit, which the Germans and Americans were just like, great, thank you very much. We'll put that into CIA operations. And so the CIA was partially funded by the people that they were spying on, which is amazing.
And then what happened in the end?
Well, basically in 2018, the CIA sold the company.
Oh.
Because it had basically become worthless because, of course, everybody had mobile phones.
Uh-huh, I see.
Who is going to be typing on the ka-ching, ka-ching old, you know, digital typewriters when you can just send fully encrypted text messages using WhatsApp, basically?
Yes.
So now we're going to get into the part of the story that I think that you're probably most familiar with,
okay,
which is the story of the Anom
yes
app.
Yes.
So in 2018, when the CIA was selling off Crypto AG, at the time, the biggest company for encrypted phones for organized criminals was a company called Phantom Secure.
Mm-hmm.
And Phantom Secure, what they sold was basically a phone that did nothing except send encrypted messages to other people who had that type of phone. You would have your normal phone, and then you would also have your Phantom Secure phone, which would send the encrypted messages, the ones that you didn't want anybody to read.
Your bad guy phone.
Yeah. The thing is, like, you and I, when you and I send WhatsApp messages to each other, that is encrypted. Nobody can read that.
It's for the best.
But the thing is that if anyone ever got a hold of one of our phones, all the messages are sitting there unencrypted on the phone.
Yeah. Yep.
But these phones, basically, if you put in the wrong passcode onto these phones, they totally erase themselves immediately. And so they're theoretically very much more safe.
Right.
So the CEO of Phantom Secure, Vincent Ramos, was arrested in March 2018 on racketeering charges. He went, yeah, I realized that my app, my company basically is entirely built to
allow criminals to chat.
And yeah. I'm aware of this and, you know, and he pleaded guilty.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a French-based equivalent, which also was being basically taken down by the authorities. Now, you may see that at this point, these guys are still going to want to buy these things.
Yeah.
But they're not just going to buy them straight from the FBI. You know, they're not going to fall for a trick like Crypto AG.
Mm.
So what the FBI did was they found the guy who was making the phones and basically said, you go to jail or you make phones for us and sell them for us.
Right.
So just the same way as the Israelis recruited the lady from Gold Apollo.
Yeah.
The FBI recruited the guy who had been making Phantom Secure's phones and made basically the same product, but now it was called Anom. And I feel like you're across what ended up happening with Anom.
I really am. Yeah. So basically they had this entire network of phones that obviously belonged to all of these criminals. This Anom technology it ended up being built by the FBI and the AFP here in Australia, and it was a way to keep tabs on every single text message that every single criminal was sending every other criminal. So basically, unbeknownst to all of these criminal syndicates who were using this, people in the offices of the FBI and the AFP were 100% across every single text message they were sending.
They might as well have just been sending it to info@fbi.gov. Yeah.
Exactly. And then I think it was in like 2021, they basically decided that, okay, we've got enough intel, obviously, on everyone. And so they kicked in like a couple of hundred people's doors and arrested all of them on one day. It was like 800 people that they arrested for sending these text messages across many countries, including Australia, but across many other countries. And it was huge.
Yeah, it was massive. But notably, do you know what country that they didn't arrest anybody in?
No. America?
Yeah. So basically, the FBI set this whole thing up, but then realized that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution basically made it illegal for them to do this.
Right.
Because it was an illegal search and seizure operation. And so they couldn't do this on American soil or to Americans. And so the FBI basically had to bring the AAP and various other international agencies on board.
Mm.
And yes, no Americans were arrested on this American plot, which is pretty crazy.
Okay, that is crazy.
And it's just the same pattern over and over again where all these companies go, oh man, if I just use a commercial system for my communications, then those guys are going to spy on me. So what I'll do is I'll circumvent that by finding a system to circumvent the vulnerabilities of the commercial system, but then it turns out that you're actually just buying it straight from the CIA.
Exactly. I think it's basically just an advertisement for just chatting, you know? Just speaking IRL.
Yeah. That's right.
The CIA doesn't own that yet.
My favorite thing about Anom, as opposed to the Crypto AG story with the typewriters, is with Crypto AG, all that was doing was encrypting the message. the CIA or the Germans still had to intercept the message, you know? Mm. So you could send an encrypted message in a letter, send it over a fax or whatever it is. The FBI still had to do a lot of work in order to try and grab that message, which they could then easily decrypt. But with the ANOM phone system, that was just directly sending it. They didn't have to do any work at all.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And they were charging a pretty large subscription payment.
My God.
For the ANOM system, and that was just going into consolidated revenue for the FBI. But, I mean, the interesting thing about all of this for me, and the reason that I think it's relevant, apart from the fact that we were talking about the pager story the other day, is, I mean, can you imagine, Cara, a situation where every intelligence agency and government and all these places around the world all started using the same CIA-connected company for all of their communications and operations? Can you imagine if, like, something like that happened?
Is this – are we talking Palantir here? Because it sounds like we're about to do it again with Palantir.
I mean, Palantir might be an entirely above-board, totally secure company. I have no idea. I don't know how Palantir's systems work. We did two episodes on Palantir just a few weeks ago, but we don't have detailed information on how it works. We've never seen the software, and even if we had, we wouldn't know how it worked. But the idea that the CIA and the FBI have this long history of creating software that very specifically sends every piece of information in a way that the NSA or the FBI can intercept and read, there seems to be a pattern that people should possibly be a little bit aware of.
Just don't accept a free phone. If you're a criminal listening, well, okay, maybe I won't talk directly to you.
Maybe we don't advise the criminals and terrorists.
Exactly. Sorry, our criminal listeners, I won't be advising you. But if somebody gives you a free phone for whatever reason, maybe think twice about taking it.
That being said, we can recommend CaraPhone.
That's
it's available now.
That's right. I won't be giving out my number on the show, but we do have an email that I do read. So please send any correspondence direct to that email.
Encrypted or otherwise.
That's right.
We're putting together another Q&A episode. So if you've got questions about anything we've covered on the show or even how we make If You're Listening, send them to ifyourlistening@abc.net.au. You can send us a written question, or even better, record your question as a voice memo so we can play it on the show. And on Thursday, we're looking at Trump's new White House ballroom and the extraordinary history of presidential renovations. Donald Trump isn't the first president to alter the White House. One 20th century president basically demolished the entire building. So why does this renovation feel so different? We'll find out on Thursday. I'll catch you then.